This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 28th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, South American presidents debate the controversial military deal between the U.S. and Colombia. Japan prepares for elections this Sunday.
They're both mainstream parties. They're both relatively conservative.
And we go to New Orleans, where Katrina victims are still struggling to find a home.
I haven't been able to find a job where I can get back on my feet and establish myself to move into one of these apartments. I haven't been able to afford that.
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Department of Justice released a memo this week indicating that hunger strikes are not just a Guantanamo occurrence. They also happened among suspected Al-Qaeda members at a supermax prison in Colorado. The 2006 memo also illustrates some dubious methods by prison guards. FSRN's Sam Greenspan reports.
Although human rights groups had their suspicions, the memo provides the first proof that hunger strikes happened in at least one other detention center. It also illuminates the manner in which guards endeavored to prevent the prisoners from communicating with one another. White noise was used in prison hallways to drown out conversations, and solitary confinement and security blindfolds were also employed to isolate prisoners. David Reams is a human rights lawyer in Washington, D.C., who is representing 19 prisoners at Guantanamo Bay.
I'm not really sympathetic to the complaint that somehow the men have found a way to communicate with each other. And that seems to be the ultimate point of the story, that no matter what you do, there'll be communications among prisoners.
The memo denies that the use of solitary confinement was used as a form of sensory deprivation. Much of the document is still classified. Sam Greenspan, FSRN, Washington.
Florida Governor Charlie Crist has chosen a replacement for Republican U.S. Senator Mel Martinez. Governor Crist spoke to the press this morning in Tallahassee.
I want you to know that I am very happy for my friend and I am extremely happy for my state. Because I know that George Lemieux will serve as a United States Senator in a way that will make all of us proud and grateful forever. Ladies and gentlemen, the next junior senator, United States Senator George Lemieux.
Audio courtesy WMNF Community Radio in Tampa. Lemieux is Governor Crist's former chief of staff. Senator Mel Martinez, the first Cuban native elected to the Senate, announced his intention to step down at the beginning of the month. Democrats are calling the selection a case of cronyism. Governor Crist says he will run for the same Senate seat in 2010. Environmental groups have filed a petition asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review a recent decision on mountaintop removal mines. Earth Justice and the Appalachian Center for the Economy and the Environment object to the Fourth Circuit ruling that allows mining companies to get around provisions of the Clean Water Act, namely the dumping of mining waste into mountain streams. In related news, two West Virginia protesters are into their fourth day of a treetop vigil aimed at stopping Massey Energy from blasting at a mountaintop removal mine above a rural community. Two members of their support crew have been arrested for trespassing. The ACLU is challenging the decertification of the Green Party as a viable political party in Arkansas. Malcolm Glover in Little Rock has the details.
In a lawsuit filed Thursday, the ACLU claims the decision by Arkansas Secretary of State Charlie Daniels violates state law and free speech rights. The Green Party decertification stems from a state requirement that a political party must get at least 3% of the vote in the most recent gubernatorial or presidential election. Rita Sklar is executive director of the ACLU of Arkansas.
Not only do people who want to run for office have a First Amendment right to get on the ballot, but the voters have a right to be able to vote for people who express views that they agree with. And if that's a member of the Democratic Party or the Republican or Green Party, Arkansas should be able to do that.
Sklar says while the Green Party's presidential candidate did not get 3% of the vote in Arkansas last year, candidates for other positions, including the party's candidate in the last U.S. Senate race, have earned more than 20% of the vote and deserve ballot access. An attorney with the Secretary of State's office had no comment on the lawsuit. Malcolm Glover, FSRN, Little Rock.
Conditions at an immigrant detention facility on the Greek island of Lesbos are deplorable, according to UN Refugee Agency staff who visited the island earlier this week. The UNHCR says the facility is designed to hold approximately 300 people, but it currently houses more than 850, mostly from Afghanistan. Spokesperson Andre Mahechich.
One room houses over 150 women and 50 babies, many suffering from illnesses related to the cramp and unsanitary conditions of the center.
Of the 850 detainees, 200 are unaccompanied children. The Greek government says the children will be transferred to special centers by the end of the month. Today, North and South Korea agreed to allow families separated by the border to reunite. After 3 days of talks, Red Cross committees for both countries have agreed that reunions will be held in North Korea over the next 2 months. And finally, August has become the deadliest month for U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan since the U.S. invasion nearly 8 years ago. A soldier killed today in a roadside bomb is the 46th member of the U.S. military to die. In July, 45 U.S. soldiers were killed. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
South American presidents are meeting in Argentina to debate a controversial military agreement between Colombia and the United States. The agreement would allow the U.S. Armed Forces to use at least 7 military bases on Colombian soil. Colombia and the State Department say U.S. forces will use the bases to conduct anti-drug trafficking operations. But some South American presidents say the bases could be used to spy on Colombia's neighbors or to launch attacks against regimes that are unfavorable to U.S. policies. Venezuela's President Chavez once again expressed his fears about the deal. This time he quoted a document from the U.S. military's Air Mobility Command.
Recently, the U.S. Southern Command has taken interest in using a location of the South American continent that could be used for anti-drug trafficking operations or for mobility operations. The U.S. Southern Command has identified the Palanquero Air Force Base in Colombia as a cooperation security location. Provided there is adequate fuel supplies, a CS-17 plane should cover the whole continent from this location, except for the southern tip of Chile and Argentina.
But not all agreed with Chavez. Peruvian President Alan Garcia said this document was not sufficient proof the U.S. planned to launch attacks from Colombian locations. Colombia's President Álvaro Uribe showed his colleagues pictures of victims of the FARC guerrillas who financed their activities with drug trafficking. In an emotional tone, Uribe said South American countries should show more solidarity with Colombia in its fight against drug traffickers and guerrilla groups.
We're talking about fighting a threat that has caused much bloodshed in Colombian society. This is not simply a theoretical debate on sovereignty or judicial rights. Europe, Canada, and the U.S. have declared these are terrorist groups, and it makes us very uneasy to see that Latin American countries have not done the same.
The U.S.-Colombia military deal comes as several South American nations are increasing arms purchases and reaching military agreements with foreign powers like Russia and the EU. Also in Argentina today, farmers are holding a nationwide strike against the government's agricultural policies. FSRN's Mary Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
Farmers camped out along highways burning tires and monitoring trucks carrying grain throughout Argentina is part of the protest that has frozen grain and cattle sales. This protest is the latest episode in a long-standing dispute between the agricultural sector and President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner over tax exports on soy. Farmers say the taxes on soy drives profits down for producers. They're also upset over the presidential veto of a farming law that would have exempted farmers from drought-struck areas from paying export levies. Eduardo Buzzi leads the Argentine Agrarian Federation.
Pero no habilita una nueva política.
We have been protesting for a new agricultural policy. Everything has come to a head with the drought. Farmers have had problems commercializing cattle and grain. And on top of that, they've experienced a severe drought, the worst drought in 100 years. They also have a state that has made millions from the countryside, but now that it has to provide assistance to farmers, it has abandoned them. All of these factors have led us to take this harsh measure. In the countryside, the economy is slowing down. There's unemployment and the recession, which is forcing the local rural population to live in the shanty towns around Buenos Aires.
Argentina has seen an explosion in genetically modified soybean production, with soy exports topping more than $16 billion in 2008. The fertile South American nation is now the world's third largest producer of soy, trailing behind the United States and Brazil. The shift to monoculture production has taken its toll on food production and on traditional farmers who are facing eviction from lands now controlled by investors in soy. The majority of soy production is controlled by growing pools or financial speculators that buy or lease land from small farmers who can't afford soy's high production costs. In all, some 47 million tons of soy was produced in 2008. Ramon Alberto Lopez, leader of a grassroots organization of displaced farmers in the northern province of Chaco, says soy has brought many social problems.
As the result of soy, more than 50% of the population was displaced from the countryside. For some, soy means profits. For us, it means death. Even if you don't want to sell your land, your field is fumigated from nearby soy fields, which inhibits crops from growing, and you can't even raise chickens.
Industry leaders warn that a prolonged strike could result in food shortages and a spike in food prices. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Japan told in parliamentary elections this Sunday. Prime Minister Taro Aso is running for re-election. His party, the Liberal Democratic Party, has ruled the country for the past 50 years through coalitions or outright majorities in parliament. But the Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, is likely to lose its grip on power to the Democratic Party of Japan. Japan is slowly recovering from a recession, and both parties have different ideas on how to generate more employment and how to restart the country's once powerful economy. But analysts say that economic policies aside, the Democratic Party of Japan's likely takeover is a significant development in Japanese history after half a century of LDP rule. Professor Jeff Kingston is the Director of Asian Studies at Temple University Japan. We called him at his Tokyo residence earlier today.
They're both mainstream parties. They're both relatively conservative. So I don't think that the DPJ victory is going to suddenly lead to dramatic changes in government policy. Yeah, the voters are voting for change they don't believe in, and for a leader they don't like all that much. What it means is they're just absolutely frustrated with the ruling party.
In a recent op-ed in the Christian Science Monitor, the DPJ leader Yukio Harayama criticized laissez-faire economics and globalization, and freewheeling globalization. And, you know, he said that politicians' responsibility is to, and I'm quoting here, to refocus our attention on those non-economic values that have been thrown aside by the march of globalism. What do you think he means by this?
Well, it may come as some surprise to listeners, but you know, the second largest capitalist economy in the world has long been very wary of market-oriented capitalism. So the government has long served to minimize and mitigate risk. They have sort of a convoy system here. Everybody goes at the pace of the slowest. So everybody is well protected. 2001, Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi comes to power on a platform of reform. His slogan was no pain, no gain. So suddenly they introduce market-oriented reforms. They deregulated and liberalized the employment system so that now one-third of the Japanese workforce is hired on temporary contracts, and they can be fired at will, and there's no safety net for these workers. I think this is what Hatoyama is referring to as sort of the Walmartization of the Japanese labor market is something Japanese people don't feel is right, and they don't think that this is the way to go.
Japan currently has an unemployment rate of 5.7%, which is the worst since World War II. Do the candidates have dramatically different plans on how to activate Japan's economic machine?
Well, I think that the LDP is sort of more of a classic trickle-down approach to economic growth. And the DPJ wants to put money in the pockets of consumers, and hence they are cutting a variety of taxes and they're giving various subsidies to families and households. And so under the LDP, the notion was, well, if we spend a lot of money on public works and we can promote exports, that if corporate Japan is doing well, then the Japanese people will do well. That model seems to have run out of steam. And not only is unemployment at record highs, the misery index overall is at a record high. You have high unemployment, foreclosures, bankruptcy, suicides, wages and bonuses are down, job security is down. So when Prime Minister Tarasso says to the voters, stay the course, everybody is saying, no, thank you.
Mm. Do you think Japan's relations with the U.S. would change significantly if the DPJ wins? Or what have both parties said about relations with the U.S.?
Well, I think that the leader of the DPJ, Hatoyama, has voiced his desire to have a more equal relationship with Washington. It's very clear the DPJ wants to pull the plug on the refueling mission in the Indian Ocean in support of NATO coalition forces in Afghanistan. And I think that, you know, Hatoyama believes that the types of boots on the ground that make sense in Afghanistan and Pakistan are nation-building boots. We're talking about development specialists, agricultural specialists, engineers, doctors, educators. But it is very clear that the Democratic Party of Japan does not support the U.S. war in Afghanistan. The Japanese people don't support this war. They think it's a big mistake. So they will help. They will contribute, mostly because they're very concerned about the situation in North Korea. And so in a way, you know, maintaining a good alliance with the United States is an insurance policy.
That was Professor Jeff Kingston from Temple University, Japan. If you'd like to listen to the full version of this interview on Japan's upcoming elections, you can head to our webpage, www.fsrn.org. Critics are reacting to news that the Pentagon is keeping tabs on reporters covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The military has contracted a company that evaluates reporters' coverage of military operations. But some say these profiles are being used to determine which reporters get access to the front lines and which don't. Tanya Snyder reports.
The Rendon Group, a private consulting firm, has $1.5 million contract with a public information unit of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. They create profiles of correspondents that cover the war, ranking reporters' coverage as positive, negative, or neutral.
This kind of profiling is not conducive to an independent press in Afghanistan.
Ernest Sagaga represents the International Federation of Journalists.
The public in America deserve to know the way the campaign is being conducted in Afghanistan. And indeed, the military also needs their public to know, because that way they can command the public support.
The Rendon Group says they provide background on the topics journalists cover so that military public information officers can prepare for the kinds of questions a journalist might have. Air Force Captain Elizabeth Mathias heads up the unit in Afghanistan that has the contract with the Rendon Group.
One of the tools we have at our disposal, other than, say, you know, just Googling a reporter, which is a fairly common practice as well, is this contract that we do have with the Rendon Group, where I can request that Rendon basically does a fancier version of the Google search.
Stars and Stripes first broke the story earlier this week. The media outlet is authorized by the DoD, but describes itself as editorially independent. Their reporters charge that the military tries to neutralize negative press by feeding positive information to journalists.
Yes, that's called public relations. That's what public relations people are trained to do. And, if you think someone has a bent, you will provide them with information. I mean, that's your right to do that, and it happens all the time.
Lucy Delglish, who directs the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, says she doesn't find any of this surprising.
I think it's naive to think that any organization that routinely has media coverage would not evaluate coverage of reporters that they think are going to be coming and spending time with them.
The military and the Rendon Group insist that the evaluations are not used to decide whether to grant or block a journalist's access to military personnel. Again, Captain Elizabeth Mathias.
journalists are not vetted or screened or otherwise judged, if you will, purely on the basis of a background created by a contract entity. The decisions that I and my command make as to who we would speak with or what interview engagements we would pursue, what embed engagements we would pursue, are based solely on our availability and our own decision as to whether or not we can support that.
Military public information officials say they use the information only to anticipate reporter questions. The only effect a negative rating would be to help the officer prepare for a more combative interview. But Howard Witt, the managing editor of Stars and Stripes, says the profiles have another purpose. He says his reporter Heath Drusen was denied a second opportunity to embed with U.S. forces, since the coverage he gave the first time he embedded wasn't exclusively positive.
It basically boiled down to the fact that they didn't like a story he did in which he went out and talked to some actual Iraqis in this town of Mosul to ask them how they felt about the U.S. presence, and the Iraqis all told him we're not happy about it. So he wrote that story, and the military did not like that story. So based on not liking that story, they denied him permission to cover that unit again.
Since the story broke, many journalists have requested and received their own profiles. Stars and Stripes is reporting that Pentagon officials are looking into the practice of profiling reporters, but that no official inquiry has been launched. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
New Orleans will commemorate the fourth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina on Saturday. Local newspapers report an increase in small businesses opening, and the city's tourism is on the rebound. Figures are up from last year, with hotel occupancy at 65% in July. Despite some signs of recovery, rebuilding efforts are still incomplete. Human rights observers in the United States and abroad continue to raise concerns about the U.S. government's approach to housing and redevelopment. From New Orleans, FSRN's Sacagawea Hall reports.
An estimated 6,000 squatters are living in abandoned buildings across New Orleans. There are more than 65,000 of them, and most aren't fit to live in. Since the hurricanes 4 years ago, the number of homeless has doubled to 11,000. Michael Palmer is one of the homeless. He's squatting in an abandoned building in mid-city left unrepaired and filled with debris from the storms.
If you travel and I'm in New Orleans, anywhere within this area, you'll see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of abandoned buildings that there has been no attention paid to renovating or doing anything. There are places where the homeless could stay. You know, there are places that they could put them.
Palmer, a former merchant seaman, was a self-employed contractor before the hurricane swept away his truck and construction tools.
I haven't been able to, so far, find a job where I can get back on my feet and establish myself to move into one of these apartments where the rent is so much higher. I haven't been able to afford that.
The market rate for rent in New Orleans has doubled and in some cases even tripled since the hurricanes, making it difficult for many residents to find affordable housing. After more than 3 years of campaigning, housing rights advocates have secured more than 700 vouchers from HUD to house the homeless and provide supportive services. Martha Kegel is the executive director of the local NGO Unity for the Homeless. She says they need many more vouchers to meet the need and will have to allocate the limited number to the most vulnerable on their registry.
And that is a registry that ranks the people living on the street and in abandoned buildings on the basis of how likely they are to die if we don't house them. Who's the most likely to die? And in fact, the person who was at the very top of the list died a few weeks ago because he hadn't gotten a voucher yet.
While specific numbers are hard to come by, advocates say the homeless population includes many former residents of public housing. The majority of public housing residents were prohibited from returning to their apartments after the storms, leaving them displaced. Then, in 2008, the four largest housing projects were demolished. HUD says the 4,500 demolished public housing units will be replaced by mixed-income housing. But according to development plans, only 3,200 units will replace the big four, and only a third of these units will be awarded to former public housing residents. Sharon Jasper used to live in public housing. She says that much of the city's public housing was virtually undamaged by the hurricanes, but they were still demolished in favor of new developments.
When they took these buildings and destroyed them because they, the government, and they feel like they can do it because this is what they want to do to make money off the land and whoever else invested money into the big four properties. So the hell with us and whoever lived there.
An estimated 25% of the New Orleans population has not returned to the city since Hurricanes Rita and Katrina. There are about 100,000 former residents living in Houston, Texas alone. Organizations like the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative argues that's because government policies have put the interest of private sector over the interest of residents. Some say redevelopment policies have denied former residents their right to return home and contributed to a rise in homelessness. International housing expert Leticia Osorio says it's clear that the rebuilding process in New Orleans is market-driven. She compared the issue of forced evictions in the Gulf Coast to other parts of the world.
It's very similar, but with the one difference, that is the richest country in the world. But here, look, they are demolishing houses and they are building new houses to replace those demolished. So they have money, but they are not investing to make people's lives better. This is very clear, you know.
The plight of homeless and low-income residents of New Orleans has attracted the attention of international human rights observers like Osorio. The United Nations agency, UN Habitat, is charged with monitoring poverty and housing. In July 2009, they sent an international advisory group on forced evictions to New Orleans to investigate the housing crisis. The independent housing experts met with former public housing residents, homeless living in abandoned buildings, mid-city residents currently facing displacement, as well as local officials and federal disaster recovery officials. The UN Advisory Group on Forced Evictions expects to publish a final report soon, including recommendations for alternative solutions to the New Orleans housing crisis. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, New Orleans.
Today marks the 46th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and the first anniversary of that march during which the United States has a black president. On August 28, 1963, an estimated 200,000 to 300,000 people marched from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial. It was here that Martin Luther King Jr. delivered the historic I Have a Dream speech.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content, we'll have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual.
That was Martin Luther King Jr. speaking before hundreds of thousands during the March on Washington 46 years ago today.
From New York, Bob Dylan.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.